From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A gubernatorial race overshadowed by accusations of unfairness from both sides ended on Saturday when officials certified Republican Brian Kemp as Georgia's governor-elect. Democrat Stacey Abrams is not challenging that outcome, but in a fiery speech slammed the electoral process that produced it. We had planned to talk about school safety today, but given the events over the weekend, instead we turned to Political Rewind host Bill Nygut for analysis. Bill, thanks so much for being here.
Glad to be here, Virginia.
So Brian Kemp will be our next governor, but Stacey Abrams did not concede exactly. Can you bring us through some of the significant twists and turns over the weekend?
How much time do we have? The election was certified by the Secretary of State's office by, again, of course, Brian Kemp has stepped down from that job. Robin Crittenden is the acting Secretary of State. And late Friday, she certified the election results from all 159 counties and declared Brian Kemp the winner. He won with a margin of some 53,000 votes. And Stacey Abrams made a speech, gave a speech to supporters out at her campaign headquarters late Friday afternoon, in which, as you said, she was defiant. She said, "I will not concede this race because of all of what she claims is corruption, malfeasance, denial of people's rights to register and to vote," and announced that she's forming a new organization, which is going to dig deeply into what she sees as problems with the election system here and corruption in the election system, and that will be her next move.
And also announced the intent to file a lawsuit.
Yes, this organization will gather evidence and information, and then she says she plans to file a federal lawsuit challenging the entirety of Georgia's election machinery.
So thanks for clarifying that. She did also say, I was reading some of the, analysis over the weekend.
Sure.
The Conservative Weekly Standard called her speech the single most ungracious and self-serving concession speech we can remember. How has it been received in general? She being regarded as a sore loser, it took it all too far?
I think we have to be look at this very carefully, because I think the way she ended her campaign is going to loom large over the next couple of years in terms of Georgia's reputation nationwide. You know, when politicians, you know this, you run a campaign, you do it with your whole heart, your whole soul. You do it with a passion that is, I think, greater than many other kinds of passion in the world, and it's very difficult to lose. I think there was some of that in Abrams over the weekend, that speech she gave. She had a lot of people around the country on her side. Oprah, for goodness sakes, was there for her. So there were a lot of people who she felt she had to perform well for. So on one hand, there's the personal aspect of it, the bitterness of defeat. But on the other hand, I think right now she needs to be very careful and balance how she moves forward. It's one thing to say, I need to pursue, as I've said all along, corruption in Georgia's election system. She believes that to be the case. Perhaps she'll gather evidence to show it. But at the same time, Georgia has to move forward. Brian Kemp is going to be the governor of this state. He's going to have to make decisions for the people of the state, for businesses. There are any number of Hollywood folks who are saying, boycott Georgia. It's a corrupt state. Brian Kemp stole the election. Alyssa Milano is one of those people. Abrams has already sent out a tweet saying, please, please don't do that. But I think she's going to have to be careful. And so, yes, conservative voices are attacking her for the way she handled herself. And on the other hand, there are liberals out there who are cheering her on. Well, what's the state going to do in the midst of that kind of polarized atmosphere? What will the stigma be that we're going to have to overcome?
Right. And for Kemp's election, his mandate, let's say,
yeah.
He doesn't, it's a pretty slim margin.
But it is a mandate. He did win the election.
Right.
And again, let Stacey Abrams prove what she can prove. But Brian Kemp will be the next governor of Georgia. And it's troubling to think that there are people out there who are going to see his tenure as being under a cloud because, like him or not, he's going to be making important decisions about our future.
Well, the norm in elections, candidates appeal to their bases in the primary elections, yeah. right? And then they try and, you know, you campaign from the fringes in the primaries, and then you run from the center, generally. But neither Kempster nor Abrams really did that. They stayed pretty much on the political extreme. So do you think Kemp is willing or able to govern on behalf of all of Georgia, given that partisan, that strategy as a candidate?
That's where the onus is on him.
Yeah.
They each have a burden moving forward. I've already said what I think hers is, to be careful about what she does to the image of this state in significant ways. Kemp has to reach out now. He has got to try to help us heal, and we'll see how he handles himself. He has his first public appearance sometime this morning. He's going to announce his transition team, and I presume when he does that, he'll have some comments to make about winning the election, and he'll have something to say perhaps about Stacey Abrams and how she ran her campaign. So the onus is on him, too, to reach out and show us that he can be a uniter.
Do you think that given all of the publicity, of course, this would have been an historic election had Stacey Abrams been elected the first Black African-American female governor in the country? We know enough about his real policies, what he was running on.
Yeah, I think we do. I think the one area where we need to know more about Brian Kemp, I mean, we know he's going to run a conservative administration.
Said he's going to continue the deal legacy.
Yes, which, by the way, was
much more moderate.
Respected by both Republicans and Democrats alike. He'll leave office as one of the most popular governors in Georgia in recent times. But the one area where I think we're going to look for Kemp very quickly to tell us what he plans to do is health care. You know, Abrams ran on expanding Medicaid. Right. She had plans for how to ensure people across the state who are disadvantaged, haven't had insurance. And she talked about that over and over again. And as the policy wonk she is, had many details. Kemp's been more vague. Kemp says, well, we should look for certain kind of Medicaid waivers. But waivers can mean a lot of different things. So I think he's going to have to fairly quickly start fleshing out for us what his real plans are for healthcare. And I'll tell you what's interesting. There are Republicans in the legislature who have been advocates of expanding Medicaid for some time now. It'll be interesting to see whether they come to Kemp and ask him to think about whether this could be an opportunity for him to do some of that healing and bridging of the partisan divide. I suspect it'll be hard for him to go there, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's Republicans as well as Democrats asking him to think about that.
Another priority, he said, was a religious liberty bill, and I'm wondering about that in the next legislative session. He says he's going to push for it. Business community largely against such a law, and a big reason that Governor Deal squashed efforts in the past to pass a bill threatening a veto. Would Kemp sign a religious liberty bill into law?
Well, so there was a... There are conservatives in the legislature, the most prominent being Josh McCoon from Columbus, who is now going to be out of office in January because he ran another race. They have pushed for a pretty harsh, looked at a pretty hard kind of religious liberty bill. What Kemp has been saying is that he would sign a bill that is compatible with the federal religious liberty bill, which was signed by President Clinton, a Democratic president, back in the early 90s. Now, the problem with that is we have no civil rights statute in Georgia, as we do in the federal law. So we're going to have to watch to see whether Kemp can balance the religious liberty advocates with the civil rights advocates who say you've got to protect all people and give some people their right to their religious convictions.
We're going to be speaking later in the show about HQ2 and what was actually in that package. But now that is off the table, does that lighten the pressure or make it much more likely that a religious liberty bill would
pass. Josh McCoon and a few other of his conservative colleagues have already said, let's get back to business. We need a religious liberty bill in Georgia. I don't doubt that it's going to come back in the next session, and it will be fascinating to watch how Brian Kemp handles himself as it unfolds. Because again, he now is representing a broader swath of Georgians. The business community does matter to him now. He's working now not just as a friend of theirs, he's now the governor of the state.
Yeah. And, of course, there's a new first lady elect, let's say, Marty Kemp. Now, the current first lady has left quite a legacy, brought a lot of issues to the fore. What do you think Marty Kemp is going to do?
I don't know. It'll be interesting to hear what she decides to take on for her agenda. I haven't heard anything about it yet. But you're right about Sandra Diehl. The people of this state... The ones who know her love Sandra Diehl because she has been a generous and caring first lady. She's deeply concerned about education, working with young people. Those are big shoes to fill.
Well, let's see. Looking forward, has Kemp gotten enough credit for winning a difficult and close race? I mean, all this talk of Georgia turning blue or purple, he pretty much kept it red.
You know, it's so hard about this election. And I go through this on Political Rewind all the time. The minute you start to say, Kemp ran a good race. I know there are people out there who don't want to hear that because they are so strongly anti-Kemp. But he decided to run his race in rural Georgia. He built up a huge margin in the rural communities of the state, outperformed President Trump in many communities, and staved off Stacey Abrams, a big vote count here in Metro. So Kemp's strategy was pretty smart to go to rural Georgia and win the votes. He does deserve credit for that. But he's not going to be able to go to the Capitol and legislate as the rural governor. There again, he's going to have to learn how to bridge a partisan divide. How does he work positively with Metro Atlanta?
Well, of course, Georgia's special legislative session extended into the weekend, started last week. Unusual to have one at all, as you and I discussed earlier on the show, let alone between Election Day and Inauguration Day. What do you think, Bill? Was that indeed the only way to speed relief from Hurricane Michael to Georgia, Southwest Georgia? Do you think there was an attempt there to influence the election at all?
No, I really don't. I take Nathan Diehl at his word on this. He felt that he needed legislative action to assure that his legislature supported the distribution of some $500 million in aid to rural Georgia. I do think he wanted to make a statement that the entire legislative body and the governor's office were supportive of all this. But he could have done that without a special session. I think many people believe that what Nathan Diehl really wanted to do was guarantee the Delta fuel tax break of some $40 million. He'd signed it into law as an executive order, but he wanted legislative approval for this before he left office. He didn't want it to get caught up in the politics of a new governor, of a new legislature. So I think more than anything else, that became really important to him. That's the takeaway that I have. And I get that from hearing an awful lot of people out there who have more closeness to this than I do.
A little legacy, a little future there with Bill Nygut. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia.
He'll be back with Political Rewind this afternoon at 2. And coming up, Bloomberg and Brookings rank Atlanta as the worst city in the nation for income inequality. We're going to look into that after the break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Research from Bloomberg and Brookings rank Atlanta as the worst city in America for income inequality. The top 5% of households in the city earn nearly 20 times the income than the bottom 20%. And that widening gap leaves fewer people in the middle. Here's what Cardiff Garcia from Planet Money said on what that means.
If the people getting ahead are the owners of capital, we have to figure out a way to help middle-class people own more capital, too.
So what does that mean here in Atlanta and the wider state of Georgia? And how do we begin to address our bottom-scraping income inequality? Mersa Baradaran from UGA School of Law joins us at our bureau in Athens. She's author of The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap. Mersa, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Alex Kammerdell is senior policy analyst. He's with the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, and he's among the author of the Institute's Inclusive Growth Report. Alex, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, so what does income inequality actually mean? What's being measured? Alex?
Sure. So we're actually talking about the concentration or the mass concentration of wealth and income in the top earners in Atlanta as well in the state. And whenever you actually do a critical analysis of who's raking in the most money, you realize that the other 99% of earners in the state are relatively far below what it takes to get by on a day-to-day basis in Georgia and in Atlanta and the metro area.
So what is the difference, Alex, between income and wealth?
Sure. So income is a useful measure of understanding how much a person brings home from a day-to-day job. Wealth is a little bit different, and it adds a lot more, I believe, texture to the conversation, because wealth is focusing on assets. You know, an example of an asset that is a huge marker for wealth for a lot of families in Atlanta and in Georgia and across the country is a home. And families that have an asset like a home are able to reinvest and transfer that wealth down generations and generations, whereas we can't actually point a finger on whether the transfer of income is having the same effect.
Mersa, I'm wondering, why did Atlanta take the top spot at the bottom? What is it make about Atlanta that makes inequality more prevalent than in other places?
Well, one of the things you have to consider is when we're talking about wealth inequality, and I think wealth inequality is a much more important indicator of what it means to be at the bottom. Income is something that is much more flexible and can change within a lifetime, but wealth tends to be one of these things that's passed generationally and really it sort of has a sedimentation quality, right? Where if you have high wealth, you're likely to keep that wealth because capital, accrues much more sort of income than income itself. So that was one of the biggest takeaways from Thomas Piketty's work is that if you have a lot of wealth, so property, stocks, whatever, you're going to keep that wealth and it's going to produce much more income than just having a job that pays money. And so one of the things, if you look at Atlanta, there are some great maps available online, and you can look at exactly the way that Atlanta was segregated racially. And you have really wonderful sort of black areas like around Morehouse and Spelman. And if you go back to these 1934 redlined maps, the FHA and the HOLC created, and you can see how the government sort of bureaucrats came in and marked up Atlanta by zones. Green zones were places where people could get mortgages. Red zones were places where people couldn't. So even in the highest black neighborhoods in Atlanta were marked as red zones. Purely because of the racial makeup of that neighborhood. And you can see it in the forms. And it's something that's really illuminating if you go back. And so those trends in segregation and the effects that they have had on home ownership and the ability to accrue wealth have not been disrupted. And so we still have this bifurcated housing market. And one of the things we saw during the financial crisis of 2008 is where, when Wall Street gets a cold, Harlem gets the flu. And so when Wall Street got a cold this time, Atlanta, the places in Atlanta that were black, where finally the black population had been able to buy homes got hit the hardest. And those are places that have not recovered. So when we talk about the recovery, the banks have recovered just fine. But those homeowners that lost their homes lost them permanently. So that's these disruptions in home ownership are things that we generally don't tend to mark on general economic indicators, but they really have a dual effect on white homeowners versus black homeowners.
Alex, this is one of the things that your report looked at specifically, that the people of color could account for about 85% of new Georgians. This is over the next three decades. So we're here from Mersa, this idea, or the laid out quite clearly, this idea of multi-generational lack of wealth accruing. What does this mean for the future of Georgia? You are looking at policy. You are looking at initiatives. What kind of suggestions are you making?
Sure. And Marissa did a very great job of detailing kind of the institutional effects of not having wealth concentrated in folks who have disproportionately been locked out of the wealth building system. We tend to forget that we are still living in the shadow of Jim Crow, of even slavery, and a lot of the laws that we are still wrestling with today are laws that were on the books decades and decades ago that very blatantly restricted access to banks, to mortgage loans, as Marissa pointed out, to even, you know, everyday things like quality education, which, you know, folks will say is an opportunity to move up the economic ladder. And those are the types of things that are still we need to address directly through public policy. And not even just through public policy, but there are institutional and systems practices that are also routinely restricting folks from building wealth, such as the implicit biases that folks are dealing with whenever they go into a bank to open a regular checking account, or the biases at play whenever a brick-and-mortar bank or institution is determining whether or not to place its building in a majority black neighborhood or not. So those are the types of things that we need to address directly and still wrestling with in 2018. And we are not doing a good job of getting away from that as we're approaching the 2030, timeline that we've laid out in our report around being a majority people of color state. And unless we are able to remedy some of these really crippling racial disparities in wealth and in income and really truly economic opportunity, then we are completely limiting the potential of Georgia.
That's Alex Kamerdale. He's Senior Policy Analyst for the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. Also with me, Marissa Baradaran. She's from UGA Law. She's also the author of a book specifically about black banking. And I wanted to get into that a little bit with you, Marissa. But first, this idea of we're talking about a lack of wealth growth in some populations, the unbanked, you know, people who don't have opportunities. But who is getting so much richer? Is that what's happening in our wealth gap, that a number of people or a small portion of people are getting so much wealthier and then people are staying at the bottom or going down? Marissa, do you have a handle on that?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, we have put in place policies over the last, you know, three decades. And this is apart from the racial sort of wealth gap segmentation, but we have policies put into effect where people of wealth can hold on to more of their wealth, pass more of that down to their children, and that their wealth is going to grow faster than people can make income. And so this is something that is broadly reflective of what we have decided as a society we're okay with, concentrations of wealth. So you see certain cities where this is really starkly apparent: New York, Atlanta, San Francisco, where you've got, you know, Atlanta less so, but some of these other cities, you've got multi-million-dollar, some billion-dollar properties, and people who are worth just astronomical levels of wealth, and then others who can barely make it. So this is something that we have allowed through policy. We've allowed it at the state level. We allow it through the local level, and we've allowed it at the federal level. And it's something that is really, really hard to detect on a day-to-day basis. But if you look at these trends over time, it's astonishing. And I think just one of the biggest sort of policy disasters. And it was abetted by, you know, bad economic theories. And, there's dark money involved, but it's not just, you know, conspiracies. It's also just, you know, this idea that if you make wealthy people wealthier, that there would be this trickle down effect and that they would be job creators. We don't talk about robber barons or aristocrats anymore. We talk about entrepreneurs and job creators, you know, as if Bezos being worth another, you know, billion will create more jobs, as opposed to using that billion to, you know, invest in public infrastructure. As an example, look at the Savannah Public Port. The Savannah created a public infrastructure project that has brought more jobs to the state than almost any other private company. And that was, public taxpayers having a long-term investment in a project that ended up creating so much wealth that the public could keep and keep reinvesting in that public space. So I think we need to, as a state, think much more about those kinds of investments.
So I want to follow up on that idea that this is something that is created through policy and something that we are okay with as a culture. But the American dream has always been, you know, somebody who gets ahead, give them all the power to get ahead. And then there's this middle class that is striving, that has continually growing. But we're talking about in a wide chasm between rich and poor, the middle class is sort of hollowed out. What does that mean in terms of growth and equality for you, Alex, as you study it?
Yeah, so the middle class is, you know, in many conversations that I've had recently about access to services, like something as simple as childcare or even transportation, they are having to make just as difficult a choice as folks who aren't even able to bring home an income. And that to us is a huge indicator of the systemic barriers that are facing working people generally, but especially those who are in the middle income band. The cost to live just without, you know, all the luxuries that many of us yearn for is incredibly high in a place like this whenever the incomes are not actually keeping pace. Over the last 10 years since the recession, Georgia has become well known for rapid economic growth. We've grown jobs and we've targeted job opportunities towards the middle income folks in the state. And the lion's share of all of those jobs have been within the $10 an hour to $14 an hour band. So what that does is that squeezes the job opportunities available to middle income folks or to folks who have the skills and qualifications for higher earning jobs.
How about outside of Atlanta? You studied income inequality statewide. Look at Cordele, Georgia. Median household income, a little over $23,000 a year. That's less than half of Atlanta's median income. So what does income inequality look like in these smaller towns across the state?
Yeah, I mean, it is obviously more concentrated in smaller and more rural parts of the state, but they're still wrestling with some of the same barriers, the systems barriers that we're dealing with in a bigger place like Atlanta. For example, I would name like housing in a place that's, you know, more rural. You know, there are parts or pockets across the state in more rural areas where folks are having to work a minimum of 80 hours a week, excuse me, at a $7.25 minimum wage just to afford a 2-bedroom apartment. And this is in places like Chatham County in Southwest Georgia, and all across the middle Georgia area as well. So I think that in the rural places, we are seeing and need to lift up and highlight that they are facing and wrestling with some of the same challenges that we're seeing here in our more urban centers like Atlanta.
So, Marissa, you have been part of drafting legislation with U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand to introduce a postal bank. How would establishing a retail bank in the postal service locations help address these kind of issues of income inequality?
I'd like to talk about another piece of legislation I worked on with Senator Warren, because I think the postal bank is reflective of a particular problem, and that's the unbanked. Mm-hmm. And what the post office would be able to do is to provide basic, you know, check cashing and, you know, financial services to people who don't have an access to a bank account. That's another different project. But on the racial wealth gap, I've worked with Senator Warren, which she just introduced a bill to talk about housing. Providing capital exactly for this problem. So let's say a place like Atlanta, she would look, the bill looks at places that were formerly segregated, like those redlined areas, or places in rural Georgia that formerly, you know, looked at, you know, you look at these segregation maps, and there really hasn't been all that much change over time. And so what the bill provides is that you would provide capital for down payment assistance. So one of the problems with the wealth gap is that people just don't have capital, like an initial, you know, they don't have a dad or a grandpa that can give them, you know, $50,000 for a down payment. And so the bill would provide that through public financing and restoring the tax cuts at the top. So we talk about, you know, dynastic wealth and intergenerational wealth. One of the ways that gets passed down is, you know, like the Paris Hilton phenomenon, right? Someone's born into a very wealthy family and they get that huge estate. Now that I think, as a recent immigrant, that goes against the American dream, right? The American dream is you work yourself for the wealth. And so we have this dynastic ability to pass wealth down. And so what it does is just restore down to the Bush level tax cuts on that wealth, and provides down payment assistance to people who have been you know, for generations excluded from these public policy and wealth building programs. And so it remedies that through capital assistance. It offers affordable housing. So one of the biggest problems in poverty is not just lack of housing, but insecure housing. So you've got, you know, kids being thrown out, evicted, you know, changing the location of housing. You know, the schools, you know, are segregated based on, you know, where you live, and a lot is determinant of that. And so the bill really focuses on that. So I've been working with Senator Warren's and several other senators to try to really get at the cause of the problem and to remedy it.
Alex, we have just half a minute left, but I'm wondering if there are other cities that have been successful in closing the wealth gap and lessening income inequality and the kind of things they've done.
Sure. So this is a very broad and very important issue across the country. It's very difficult to actually point to places that on a large scale that are actually doing a great job at closing the wealth gap. But a lot of local places are experimenting. I would look to, in terms of the housing market, Dallas is doing some really incredible things around providing affordable housing and really modeling some of the things that Senator Warren has also presented. Obviously, places like Seattle and San Francisco and LA are constantly in an experimentation mode, not always doing the greatest job, but always experimenting and open to new ideas. So
lots of ideas on the table. Alex Kamerdel, Marisa Baradaran, thank you so much, both of you, for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Coming up, we're going to explore Atlanta's failed Amazon HQ 2-bit. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A little over a year ago, Amazon started a frenzy around the country, not by introducing a new smart speaker or promising free same-day shipping. The tech giant announced it was searching to locate a second headquarters. Here's the Saturday Night Live spin on Amazon's HQ2 selection process.
Alexa, are we ready for the presentations?
Yes, sir. We are down to 20 cities for our new Amazon headquarters.
Great. The winning city would get 50,000 new jobs and billions of dollars. Alexa, isn't this exciting?
Yes, it is exciting.
And just to make sure, Alexa, who is the richest man in the world?
The richest man in the world is Jeff Bezos.
Close enough. Let's begin.
I'm sending in the delegation from Boston.
That would, of course, be Jeff Bezos, Amazon's founder and CEO. And as we know, Georgia did not win Amazon's HQ2. Instead, the second headquarters will be split between Arlington, Virginia, and Queens and New York City. With Amazon's announcement and the opening of a special legislative session last week at the state capitol, the secret details of Georgia's Amazon offer were made public. Maggie Lee, she's a freelance reporter who covers state and metro government and joins me in the studio with some of those details. Maggie, thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Ron Knox is editor of the Global Competition Review. He writes about antitrust issues. He's here with us from KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. Ron, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, Maggie, before we get into the details of what Georgia offered to Amazon, why did it take more of a year than a year for incentive package to even become public?
Well, that's state law here. Normally, most records produced by state government are a public record that you can get if you ask. But things like this, pitches to companies that are considering moving to Georgia, those are allowed to be kept secret on competition grounds. A state law makes them secret. They say, oh, we don't have to tell everyone what we're offering Amazon or any other company that's thinking of moving here, because they want to protect their competitive edge. They don't want, like, Alabama or South Carolina to do an open records request and see what we're offering any given company and underbid us by, you know, a dollar.
Now, we did hear from the Saturday Night Live skit about Amazon's second headquarters. Now, this is how SNL portrayed Atlanta's bid when Georgia made its first pitch to Amazon in October of 2017. This was a month after the company announced its search for a new headquarters. This is from January, when Amazon named Atlanta as one of the 20 finalists.
Hey, look here, man. Atlanta made for business, okay? Our airport's only 20 minutes away from downtown.
2 hours for traffic.
We had the Olympics there back in 96.
The one with the bomb.
And you know, Atlanta has these wonderful places where people from all walks of life come together.
It's called the Waffle House.
Yeah, we ready. So today we present you some of the symbols of our city, a can of Coca-Cola, and a sandwich from Chick-fil-A.
Maggie, as we know, the deal offered Amazon was a little sweeter than Coca-Cola. How much did Georgia promise Amazon in tax incentives?
Well, there's the state component, and then there's the component offered by the various cities, the headline one being Atlanta. But the state's headline figure is $1.7 billion, and most of that is essentially a tax credit. So Amazon essentially wouldn't have to pay some taxes, and they could use the money how they wanted to. The city of Atlanta also offered incentives. So did the city of Doraville. So did Gwinnett County. So did Cobb County. The amounts vary, but you know they're all pretty much in the nine figures. And it's property tax abatements. It's Gwinnett County offered to essentially buy the land where the headquarters would be built near Infinite Energy Arena and rent it back to Amazon very cheaply. So, you know, you're looking at no matter which of these sites they may have chosen, the incentives would come to more than $2 billion, mostly in tax abatements, you know, maybe getting close to $2.5 billion in some of these places.
So, Ron, you, Georgia, of course, not the only state that lost out on the deal. So many cities and states clamored to win HQ2. How did this compare to what other local and state governments offered Amazon, like Kansas City, where you are?
Sure. Well, you know, they aren't all public yet. And I think that some of the cities and states that lost out in the first round before the list got reduced to 20 cities and states, they, you know, really haven't made theirs public. But of the ones that have, you know, Atlanta and Georgia's bid is really not even close to the top of the list, right? You look at Montgomery County, Maryland, $8.5 billion in incentives for Amazon to move its second headquarters there. That includes a $6.5 billion tax incentive package, plus a lot of other infrastructure money and so on. You know, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, $5.7 billion. You know, more than $2 million in Chicago, $7 billion in Newark, New Jersey, $5 billion of that in incentives over 10 years. So you see a lot, really like an incredible amount of money that's being thrown at Amazon. I would suspect this is, you know, the greatest use of tax incentives and taxpayer giveaways to land one company you know, really in history, anywhere.
Well, and still, those did not work in Philadelphia and there in Maryland. Maggie, the SNL skit did reference Atlanta traffic. Certainly seems that the Georgia project team considered that in offering some additional incentives. So what did they propose as far as public transportation goes to Amazon?
Well, what's gotten a lot of attention is this MARTA thing.
The MARTA thing being a separate MARTA car for Amazon employees?
Well, what it says is MARTA would be committed to exploring the possibility of a company-dedicated car to the MARTA train, which would be used to distribute products. I'm not sure about other cities offering subway cars to deliver Amazon products. I'm not sure if that's an employee car per se, but essentially, yes, Atlanta and Georgia did get MARTA in the room and talk to MARTA and be like, what can we offer these people? Because we do have awful traffic, MARTA. How can you step up?
Actually, there was an Onion headline that said that in New York City, the subway was going to be used by Amazon employees, which was, of course, a joke. And, you know, this is something that's easy when we compare these offers to joke about. But there's tremendous economic boon at stake here. And there's a reason why cities were giving it their all. But Maggie, some of the other things that were in that package, the interesting proposals to Amazon.
Well, I think what Amazon probably would be looking at would be the 8 and 9 figure tax incentives. But there are, you know, other little offers in there. Atlanta's package says we would you would have the opportunity to explore road renamings. You could have Kendall Road. Gwinnett offered a lot of things, a property tax break on private airplanes. I guess you'd be flying into Briscoe. they offered a set of tickets to the Aurora Theater in Lawrenceville. They were going to, you know, hook up the C-suite with some season tickets to the theater. An interesting one, CEO offered role in annual Nutcracker as Mother Ginger. So they were perhaps giving Jeff Bezos a role in a ballet.
I can't believe that didn't bring him in here. But I was interested in the exclusive lounge at the airport with parking at the world's busiest airport.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in that Saturday Night Live sketch, they joke about where downtown is 20 minutes from the airport. As always, the airport played a big role in this pitch. They talk about, you know, you can fly anywhere, you know, anywhere in the world pretty quickly. This pitch talked a lot about training that could be offered through University System of Georgia or Technical College System of Georgia. Georgia Tech was mentioned a lot. You know, they put out a lot of CS graduates every year. So, you know, it was kind of a typical pitch. We got an airport. We got, you know, higher education. We got low cost of living. We got tax incentives.
All right. Well, Ron, enough about the losers. What about in the winners? What did New York and Virginia offer Amazon in terms of incentives beyond already being established as two powerful economic centers on the East Coast?
Yeah. I mean, I think really it was more the latter than the former, right? I mean, you know, the package that that New York put together for Amazon is very similar to the one that Georgia put together, $1.7 billion. Most of that was going to be in tax credits. And then a lot of infrastructure money to build, the offices that Amazon will eventually be in. And then Virginia's package was actually quite a bit less. I mean, it was, a couple hundred million dollars in the new site. And then essentially tax incentives that work out to be about $22,000 in tax credits per job. And in New York, it was $48,000, per job, and that's just with that $1.7 billion that doesn't include a lot of other infrastructure use that I think the city is going to do, and so on. I think it's more, and that was nowhere near, as we've heard, that was nowhere near what some other cities and states, you know, offered the company to get them to move there. So I think really what you end up with is, you have a company that's, extraordinarily powerful. And it went through, this bidding process. Not exactly sure what the company, was looking for. I don't, the incentives are great, and I'm sure that they'll be happy to not pay taxes for, for 20 years or whatever it might be. But I think it's pretty clear at this point that they were looking for some other things from their destinations, whether it's, great infrastructure already in place, educated workforce, close to power and so on. And I think that, that New York and D.C. are obviously both big centers for both for commerce and for power, and so on. So what did Amazon get out of that whole process? If it clearly wasn't interested in whoever was going to throw, the most money at it, it got a lot of data from a lot of different places about what exactly they're willing to part with if Amazon is willing to move some jobs there. And that is extremely valuable to Amazon.
Well, and to perhaps other companies that are going to make the ramp into these same cities. Ron, last week in Slate, you argued that the company's contest for extracting massive subsidies from cities shows how it flexes its monopolistic power. Sorry, I'm in trouble with even that word.
Yeah.
So, but Amazon did gain from these cities, but you compared the negotiations with the way that Amazon uses the data of retailers who sell products on Amazon's marketplace. So how is Amazon going to use that data?
Well, I mean, I think, the data that it collects from cities, I think it's pretty, clear at least one possible use of that, and that's the next time Amazon needs to build a warehouse or, build a data center somewhere, it has a really good idea about what a city and state is willing to part with in order to pick up some jobs. That's an advantage for Amazon, for a company like Amazon that's already extraordinarily powerful, both in, the realm of commerce and, in the political world as well. I mean, Amazon's a huge gravity center. For politics, And for commerce, and in order, and you know, when you give a company like that access to, essentially, these cities laid bare, exactly what they're willing to give up, that's something that really no other company, in the country has, these cities and states knew how valuable this data was because they weren't willing to part with it easily, right? That's why you had to go through the open records requests and so on. But now all of that lives with Amazon. So the next time it goes out and needs a place, to build something, it has a way to make sure that it gets the best deal and that a company that potentially competes with it cannot get that same deal.
But you go beyond that, Ron, however, and make the case that Amazon's practices with HQ2 and with competitors is actually an antitrust issue. How is that? How so?
Well, I don't know that the HQ2 issue is necessarily an antitrust issue. The point that I was making in the article, and that I think is true, is that if you're one of the antitrust agencies in the U.S., you should look very closely at the HQ2 process to see how it went, to learn how the company uses its power to gain advantage over the market, over essentially suppliers, and over its rivals. So I think that the way that the company treats its suppliers on its marketplace. It's very, very similar to the way that it treated these cities. It said, you need us. Amazon can make that claim. And that's exactly what the power of Amazon does. It allows the company to say, you need us. If you want to sell your thing, if you want to sell your shirts, your refrigerator filters, whatever it might be, you have to come to us and use the marketplace because more than half of all sales on the internet are made on Amazon, right? And in order for you to come to us, you have to give up something. You have to let us use all of your data. Every time you make a sale, we know about it. We know who bought it. We know when they bought it. We know how much of it they bought and so on. And then, Amazon, at times, right, in the marketplace decides, you know what, that's a pretty good business. We're actually going to start selling that thing too. So we're going to start selling those T-shirts. We're going to start selling those refrigerator filters. And we know we have this, trove of data that tells us exactly the best way to sell it and exactly who to sell it to, exactly when to sell it and so on, and what the price point should be. More importantly, it treated the cities the same way. It said, you need us. We're going to come in with 50,000 jobs, even though it didn't deliver that. And this extremely high-tech, educated workforce, and this, it's going to be an incredible economic boon to your city. You need us. You give us everything you got. You give us all your data. And then at the end of the day, it did not deliver the thing that it said it would deliver. It took twice the subsidies, right? It took subsidies from New York and from Virginia, and it delivered half the jobs, half the headquarters that it said it would. So I just think the treatment of suppliers, both for the cities and for the folks who sell in the Amazon marketplace, extremely similar. And if you're an antitrust official and you're interested in how Amazon operates, you should pay attention to that.
Ron Knox, he's editor of Global Competition Review. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Sure. Thank you.
And freelance reporter Maggie Lee, thank you so much.
Sure.
So I guess you're going to be watching, Maggie, if somebody's going to come swoop in and take advantage of all of this work that they've done here in Atlanta and Georgia. What do you think?
Well, these offers, the offers that Georgia and Atlanta made are pretty standard. I think they'd be there for pretty much any company.
Well, thank you. And that's our show for today. But we would like to hear from you. What did you think of the multi-billion dollar package for your tax dollars Georgia offered to Amazon to win HQ2? You can leave us a message. We're at 404-500-9457. You can reach us on Twitter or on our Facebook group. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and LaRaven Taylor. Alex Word is our engineer, although Tyler Moore is helping out today. Amy Kiley, our senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.